Brothers in Blue Reentry. Real voices.
Real life stories of real life men. These are the many voices of the Brothers in Blue Reentry Program. Real voices. Welcome to this week's edition of Real Voices. This week, you are invited to hear the story of one young man caught up in the despair that he created for his own life, by his own decisions, by his own actions. In his own words, he reveals the inner workings, the internal motivations that shaped his life choices, which ultimately led to his incarceration. Hear how seemingly unimportant decisions he made culminated into a life interrupted, into a life that continued to spiral out of control. One mistake, another blunder, one more opportunity missed, a series of misguided steps. This recording is one inmate sitting down to interview his fellow inmate. Asked are frank questions in want of real answers. Nothing sugar-coated, but at essence, real dialogue in hopes of glimpsing a moment in the life of one. His reality, his life, right or wrong, his story. This recording is meant for mature audiences only. The only editing done to this recording was to clarify statements or omit extraneous information that didn't serve the purpose of this recording, which is simply to offer vignettes of a life. Here, we also pierce the veil that's oftentimes shrouds penitentiary existence, a peek behind the scenes into the lives that make up Brothers in Blue Reentry. Thank you for listening to Real Voices. Have you been incarcerated?
I've been incarcerated for 11 and a half years, a little over.
What are you incarcerated for?
I'm incarcerated for 2 counts of ag robbery and 1 count of aggravated assault.
What happened?
One day I was hanging out with my cousin at a hotel room, and he's a drug dealer, I wasn't. A guy came into the room wanting to buy drugs, and they made up a drug deal that this guy was going to pay my cousin to go get the drugs for him. So he gave him $100 to go get the drugs, and when he came back, he was going to pay him the money for the drugs, so the $100 was just to go get it. Well, we left and we came back after we got a phone call from the guy sending the, basically my cousin told me he needed more money, so the guy called him back to the hotel room. When we got there, my cousin decided instead of just taking the money and not coming back, he decided he was going to rob him and take all their money. So when he pulled the gun, he robbed the guys. He pointed the gun at one guy, demanded his money and took it. He pointed to the second guy, yelled at him for a little while, threatened his life or whatever, and took his money. While he was arguing with the second guy, the first guy jumped up and wrestled for the gun. They wrestled back towards me. I stepped out of the door. I was about to leave, and I realized I couldn't because this guy's my cousin. So I went back in. I punched the guy that my cousin was fighting over the gun. When he fell, my cousin left me, and I got held there by them and one third guy who happened to come back to the hotel room during all this fighting.
How much time did you receive?
I had 17 years, or exactly 206 months.
What were you like as a person before this case?
I think that I've always been a good person, you know. I mean, probably everybody say that, though. I didn't do too much as far as committing crimes. I was going to school full-time to be a graphic designer. I was working full-time as a customer service rep for the United States Postal Service. I was going pretty good. I had a couple of nice job offers, one for American Insurance, selling insurance. That was a pretty good job. I was out looking for a home also. I was about to purchase my first home. Things were looking good for me.
How old were you when you came to prison?
I caught my case 2 days before I turned 20, and I came to prison at 20 and turned 21 shortly after.
What was going through your mind during that transition?
Pure terror. I was afraid. I'm only 5 feet 5 inches tall, and I probably weighed 115, 120 pounds. And when you see the movies, you see these big birdy guys and muscles and everything, and you see these guys being raped and stabbed and mugged and all the things you see about on TV, I was expecting. Now, mind you, I've done juvenile time before, but I wasn't prepared for this. There was no way to prepare for this.
What was your first night like in prison?
My first night in prison. I can remember my first day here, clearly. When I first came here, they took me to the clinic, made sure I was, I guess, disease-free, took blood samples and all of that, and I went to my cell house. Shortly after that, we went to lunch. When I got to lunch, I sat down at one table, And the guy walked up to me and sat down at the table. He said, "Hey, man, are you Hoover?" I said, "No, not Hoover." He said, "You gotta go." So I got up and left and went to another chair. I sat down.
What is Hoover?
Hoover's a Crip. It's a Crip gang. One of the Crip steps. And I sat down at another table. The guy sat down at the table beside me. He said, "Hey, man, are you Muslim?" I said, "No, I'm not Muslim." He said, "Hey, man, you can't sit here." So I got ready to get up and leave. And he said, "Hey, man, look, you can sit there as long as you need to, but when my friends get here, you got to move." So I said, "Okay, fine." So that's what I did. I sat down, I ate, and I left. And I made sure I ate quickly. But the next day, I was pretty cool. I met a couple of my relatives here, and I was pretty cool after that. I had somebody look after me and show me what was going on.
What has your experiences been like growing up in prison?
I think it's pretty cool that you say growing up in prison. That's what I feel like I did. I believe when you walk into prison, you're almost a child all over again. Just like when you were a kid, initially, you have to learn to sit up, turn over, then crawl, then stand up, and then take steps. I think in prison, when you come here, it's the same way. You have to learn the rules first, and the DOC rules aren't the rules you learn first. The first rules you learn are the prison rules, the penal code, the inmate code, the convict code, as they say. Once you learn those things, then you worry about the DOC rules, then you worry about the state laws, and then you worry about, basically, your own survival. And that's really what gears all your thoughts when you come to prison. I think the prison, they say, is for rehabilitation, and I believe that that's what it's for. But I think more often they confuse the rehabilitation with being preyed upon. I think that's the main purpose of prison. They send you here to be preyed upon, like you preyed upon people out there in the real world. And when you deal with things like that, you find yourself playing the victim role, I guess you could say, even when you shouldn't be.
Have you ever felt like a victim?
For about 10 years, I felt like I wasn't the reason I was here. My cousin was the reason why I was here. Because had he not robbed these people, I wouldn't be here. And then a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, I came to a realization that I'm responsible for my actions. I realized that he wasn't living the same type of life I was, and I was still hanging out with him. I realized before that he was going to do this robbery that he didn't have good intentions. And I realized that the influence I had on him far outweighed the influence that he had on me. So when he proposed this idea, I could have simply said, "Hey man, don't do it, it's a bad idea." But since I didn't have the courage to do so, I'm the reason why I'm here. Even after he apologized, I had to send a letter back to him and say, "Hey man, you're not the reason why I'm here, I am." So when you grow up in prison, you gotta come to the fact, or really as you grow up as a man, you have to come to the fact that you're responsible for your actions, whether or not you did what they're accusing you of doing or not. I'm still the perpetrator of my actions that got me here.
What did that process look like?
Wow, it hit me like a brick. I've done all kinds of things in this prison that I'm not very proud of now. And I feel like that the reason why I did those things was because I didn't feel like I had to follow the rules since I didn't do anything to come to prison. And I went and did all these things I did over the years. And what I did was cause myself way more problems than I needed. I'm losing good time for things I really don't have a reason to do.
The KDOC awards so-called good time credits for good behavior, which can result in the inmate leaving prison at an earlier release date. For example, an inmate who receives a 10-year sentence, if he has received no disciplinary infractions, or DRs, can leave prison having only served 8.5 years. This is an incentive to encourage inmates to behave while incarcerated. However, these same credits are taken back for infractions incurred by the inmate, in effect, lengthening his stay in prison.
Over the years, after I've lost all the good time that I've lost, I haven't lost much, but I kept losing it, and I want to leave as soon as I can, not be here as long as I can. So I had to come to that realization. I didn't want to be here anymore. But more than that, I think the more and more I did the things that I was doing, the more and more I proved to DOC and the people who put me here that I belonged here, because I'm starting to look like everyone else was here. And that right there kind of, it humbles you. It humbles you a lot. I was doing a lot of things I was doing, getting notoriety in prison, to be viewed as somebody who was in the mix, to know who to go to get certain things, you know. I wanted to be the cool guy. I wanted to be the guy who had all the extras in prison. I wanted to be regular. I wanted to be like a regular person, except to be regular in here compared to out there in the real world or the free world, you you do a lot of things that you shouldn't have to do. In the real world, you can work more to earn a living for yourself, you know. If you can't afford to pay your rent, you can work overtime or you can get a second job. In prison, when you don't have the things you want or the things you feel like you need, you have to do extra things to do that, to get that. One could be trafficking drugs. One could be extorting other inmates. One could be stealing from other inmates or stealing from the kitchen to sell the things that you get to gain extra income you might want. You can just do drugs here. You can do many of things, and really, I can't even number the things that a person can do for fun to gain extra money. But there are also things you can do here that are legitimately good things for other people to also get funds also. But that just wasn't on my radar. I didn't think about it.
Have you gone to the hole?
Yeah, I've been hole 4 times.
The segregation unit, also known as the hole, is where inmates go for misbehaving. Bite, contraband, undue familiarity with staff. There's a whole rule book that lists what not to do.
The first time I went to SEG, I was in SEG for 2-3 weeks. I got caught with 2 cell phones, shank, which is a homemade knife, prison-made knife. It's a slang term. I had $50 cash, some cigarettes, and like pictures of naked women. I went to the SIG and my monkey took the write-up, said everything was his so that I would get out, so he was looking out for me. And that's a part of the inmate code again. I was the one who had access to most of the money we needed to get these things. So he took the DR so that I could get back out and look out for him when he got out the hole. So that's basically what that was. So he's basically putting himself in a position for me to look out for him even longer. The second time I went to the hole was for undue familiarity and a knife again. I was in a relationship with the staff member here who worked in the kitchen, which is frowned upon, just not supposed to happen. The knife, I actually had the knife because I was in situations where I was dealing with another inmate who liked this woman, and he was trying to get me out of the picture so that he can get her and get what he could get out of her. And so that was causing friction almost to a life-threatening point. So I got the knife basically to protect myself. My third time, again, was for undue familiarity. But I didn't get a DR for it because they didn't have any proof for it. So what they did was they sent me to the hole for a razor blade that I had that I was using to prepare my food for my meals. So I went down there and they asked me if I knew what I was there for. I said, yeah, I had a knife. They said, no, you're here for more than that, but we'll talk about that later on. So that was my third time. My last time I got caught with a cellular phone out in the medium facility. I bought that phone to make phone calls to my family, but also to meet new people. So I got on the internet and I was surfing the internet meeting women. So that's my fourth time and my last time, hopefully.
What did you do in the hole?
Not much to do in the hole. You're just there. Your warehouse. You get up in the morning, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, you eat breakfast, you lay back down, sleep. If you have books, you can read, but the books are hard to get to in the hole. But just about every time I went to the hole, it was just laying in bed. You know, you'll get up every now and again, you'll do some exercises, push-ups, sit-ups, or something to keep your mind occupied. There were a couple times I started writing books, but I never really finished them because I ran out of paper. And I wrote a little bit of poetry also while I was down there.
Do you like to write?
A little bit. It kind of clears my mind a little bit, especially when I have something big on my chest, a lot of stress. What I'll do is I'll write a poem or I'll write a letter to a family member or a friend that I might not even expect to get a letter back from, just to get it off my chest without having to worry about somebody worrying about me. This is a poem I wrote called Caged. I was in a state when I wrote this, and this is kind of when I came to my realization that I had to change a few things. Say, it's amazing what kind of situations you find yourself in when you finally have a moment of clear thought. I'm in the hole in a maximum security prison. Now, I've been in this prison for the last 10 years. I'm 29 years old. I'm alone and lonely, but also isolated from even my own mind. I have no idea how I got to this point. Don't misunderstand me. I was awake for the whole progression, just lost in a sense of how I came to this particular point. I don't even have a clue as to how I'm supposed to proceed. I feel like I'm in a cage, walking on a hamster wheel. I can walk for hours, but I like a mile so engrossed in making some progress that when I finally step off the wheel, although the view outside of my cell has changed, nothing has changed concerning me and my situation. I've learned that the mind is a pretty unique thing. We have legs to carry us places, but our mind also have legs. We wander from here to there. You can completely lose your mind and never realize it. I think that's what happened to me. Me and my mind walk in sync for long periods, and somehow we get separated. And we meet back up, I find myself in the damnedest predicaments. This craziness started when I was 15 years old, then again when I was 17, then 19, and again at 24, 26, 27, 28, and now at 29. The truth is, I don't know if I'm just stupid to keep making mistakes that I should learn from, or if I'm completely insane. Maybe my mind just don't like who I've become, since it seems to lead me more now that I'm older. Then again, maybe I ought to follow my mind since I'm the one messing up. What do you think?
When did you hit your rock bottom?
I had plenty of rock bottoms in prison. Plenty. I lost one aunt to sickle cell, and that was one point. I lost another aunt to cancer, that was another low point. I lost my great-grandmother to cancer, that was another low point. And just recently, I lost another auntie. It's hard. I think my low point so far has been when I lost people because they made me focus on what I'm missing out on. My auntie, the first auntie that passed away was my rock. When I first got incarcerated, I couldn't call mom or dad. I couldn't call my sisters and brothers and talk to them about what I was feeling. But my aunt was there, you know. And when I talked to her, she didn't talk bad to me. She didn't make me feel even worse than I was already feeling. She kind of encouraged me to be strong, and that helped me get through my first couple years in prison. And when she passed away, it took all of that back from me. It took all that back from me almost to the point to where I had to sit and think about what I was really, really doing here. Why am I here? Why am I here? What am I really doing? And it came to a point to where I was thinking about it, and I realized that my decisions got me here. And I started thinking about decisions, and most people think of decisions as good and bad, but I realize more to decision making than that. You also got good and better, or great and greatest, not just right and wrong or good and bad. And I think what I've done in my life, I've used my ignorance to make decisions. I wasn't thinking progressively when I made decisions. I would just do it, and then I find myself in a bad situation. And then really when I'm trying to get out of that situation, I find myself getting more and more away from the path that I was trying to go because I wasn't thinking ahead of time. And so every time I made those decisions, I find myself in a worse situation, a worse situation, a worse situation. But I probably had to say my rock bottom was this last DR I had for the cell phone. That right there, my uncle came to see me, and I hadn't seen him in years. And he said, hey, did you get anything out of it? I mean, was it worth it? In truth, I got nothing out of it. But I wanted to feel like I got something out of it because it was a decision I made. You know, I want to be confident in the decision I made. But I had to be truthful with them and say, no, I didn't get anything out of it. But in my mind, I'm thinking, well, if I had a little bit longer, I would have. But that didn't matter. I wasn't supposed to have the cell phone. I had it. I got caught with it, and I didn't get anything out of it. So, no, I didn't. But he said, son, you know, sometimes you got to sacrifice to get the things you want in life. If you want to get out of here, you got to sacrifice the things you're doing right now to get out of here as soon as you can. And then we get out of here, you got to sacrifice a lot of time, a lot of effort to just get on a level to where you can just live comfortably. And that right there kind of rocked my whole ideology about life. I wanted what I wanted. I wanted to be like everybody else, but I wouldn't do the things other people were doing to get what they had. Or not righteously anyway.
When did you join Brothers in Blue?
I came into the program March 1st of 2011.
What has your experience been like in the program?
Man, it's kind of hard to describe how good this program has been. Over the 11 years that I've been here, I've tried joining programs to help better myself. I did JCs, I was in AAO, African American Awareness Organization, I was in Stop Violence. I was trying to find some kind of way to grow and help myself. And over the years, DOC would tell me, oh, you can't buy these books because they cost too much. I went to college for a little bit, but I couldn't afford to keep going once I lost my private industry job. So I had to quit that. So it seemed like every time I tried to get something going, there was a roadblock right there holding me back. And it's kind of hard to want to grow, and someone slaps your hand every time you make an effort to do so. So my joining BID, I felt like those restrictions were pulled back from me. They were, I'm free to grow. I'm free to do the things that I know are going to benefit me. And first things first, I had a good relationship with God and understanding how great God is and understanding how he's there for you even when you don't know he's there for you. When I look back on my life, I realize he's been there for me a long time with all the dumb things I've done in my life, and I'm still here for him. I'm better for him now that I understand that he has all these plans for me, whether or not I know what they are or not. He put me in a position to come over here in this program. He put these people in my way to learn from them, to counsel me. They say, as iron sharpens iron, so does man sharpen the countenance of other men. I've been put around men who live the things they say, who live the things they teach. And I can really, really appreciate that. When I'm not dealing with people who are scheming on ways to tear somebody else down, I'm better for it. I get up in the morning, I go to my classes, I get a devotion every morning to prepare me for that day. They prepare me for whatever ills I got to deal with that day. I sit in the classroom that's going to teach me how to be a man, how to worship God in the right ways, how to live accordingly to God's word, and how to be a man of my family, you know, and not just be there, not just waste space in life to actually do something with it. That's what the BID has done for me. It's given me a little bit more room to really focus on the things I need to focus on in life and not just warehouse myself in prison. I really appreciate it, and I'm grateful for them.
What about the volunteers that come in here? What does that mean to you? To see strangers come into a prison and participate in our lives.
Again, I like to quote another scripture. The Bible says, there's none greater than this, than for a man to lay down his life for a friend. These people don't know me. They don't know me, but they care. I've seen some of these volunteers more than I've seen some of my own family members. I love that. I really appreciate that. I understand that they got lives out there. They have children they love, family they want to be with. They got children whose games and choir recitals or whatever they got going on in their lives. A lot of times they sacrifice those things to come in and spend time with us to make sure we have the things we need to survive in life, to grow in life, you know, to show God our appreciation for all the things that he's given us, to really open our eyes to what's really going on in the world and our lives, you know. Man, there's no word that can describe how appreciative I am of the volunteers I've met here. Some of them come here, man, with nothing else in mind other than helping. And you can never, 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 ever, ever not appreciate that. Ever.
This week, during community devotions, a Brothers in Blue reentry counselor asked the men a trick question. If a man starts off on the wrong path, can he end up on the right path? Think about it. Change doesn't happen in a vacuum, but because of relationships. For the man you just heard, it took a voice of reason, a helping hand to reach down and pull him up out of the mess and mire he made of his life. A troubled life made through a series of misguided steps in the wrong direction. Of course, the answer to the counselor's question is no. To go in the right direction, an individual must get off the wrong track. Period. He must go in a different direction. The Brothers in Blue Reentry Program attempts to turn men around in the direction they should go, a direction that leads to changed thinking, changed behavior, and ultimately, changed lives. We reach men while they're still incarcerated, in the rock bottom state of mind, and set them on the right track. In this program, many lives are impacted by relationships built with mentors and volunteers that come into the prison, speaking wisdom, hope, and guidance into the minds and hearts of the men in the program. So what's the connection to you? Brothers in Blue Reentry. Because what happens in prison matters. It matters that change must happen. And we need your help to ensure that it does. Thank you for listening to Real Voices. Please tune in next week.